Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to the Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. This week, I will be presenting Dina Stryker, the author of Cuba, A Diary of the Revolution. Dina is a Philadelphian. She studied in Paris. She became a French citizen by marriage. She began her career in France, then traveled to Cuba uninvited and unaffiliated, interviewing Fidel Castro for a major French weekly. She would meet with Fidel again a week after the Kennedy assassination and several times in 1964, along with all the members of the Cuban government to get their personal stories, while chronicling the salient events of that year. Dina is a senior editor at opednews.com and a contributor to New Eastern Outlook. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back with Dina Stryker. Dina Stryker, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Hi, Cindy. I'm really honored to be here.
Well, thank you. As I told you when we were chatting a little bit before, that this is going to be an awesome show for the 4th of July weekend.
Absolutely. The first 4th of July after the United States finally made peace with Cuba.
Well, I have some thoughts about that. I don't think the United States really ever makes peace with anybody.
Oh, right. I hope I said that in an ironic tone.
Oh, okay. Okay. Good. Right. So before we get into that, because, you know, I have a lot of experience for the average American, really, with Cuba, and I've been to Cuba many times. But tell my listeners a little bit about yourself before we get actually into the meat of the interview.
Okay, well, you're letting your listeners in for maybe a long tale, but I'll try to make it short. I was born in Philadelphia. I was taken to France right after the war because my father was there on the staff of the Stars and Stripes, the occupation troops. But he didn't like the dependent schools in Germany, the schools for American dependents, so he sent me to live with a French family in Paris by myself. I was 14 years old, and I only knew a few words of French. So I got an early start in doing things that most people don't do and somehow managing to come out okay. And I stayed in France for a number of years, went to school there, got married, acquired a French passport. And in 1963, I was living in Italy, where I had been living for the past 5 years or so. And I was working for the French news agency in Rome. And I met a few people who had been to Cuba, and this was like, you know, in the months following the missile crisis. And they all told me that the revolution was really very interesting and very genuine and not at all like what the papers were saying. So I had written a book called The 200 Days of 8½, which followed Federico Fellini as he filmed the famous film 8½. And when the book was published, I had a little bit of money, and I decided to go to Cuba and see what was going on for myself, because I was a sort of newcomer to the world of journalism, and it was disturbing to me to think that that journalists were not doing their job right.
Right. So you had the opportunity of a lifetime then to, as you know, someone who was is a U.S. citizen, able to travel to Cuba at that time,
It was, to me, I was, you sound like a kid, by the way. you don't sound like somebody who was, 14 during the World War II at all. So anyway, in 1963, I was 6 years old, and of course, Cuba and the Soviet Union were painted as these evil, dangerous entities. And mm-hmm. I remember the missile crisis. I don't remember it per se, but I remember how upset the adults around me were.
Right.
And so you had the chance to go at, by the way, I didn't get your book in time. I didn't get it until yesterday, so I haven't really had a chance to read it, but I am going to read it. So this will be all new information to me, too. So you found yourself in Havana, and go from there.
Well, I didn't exactly find myself in
Havana. Oh, I'm in Havana. How did you get there?
First, I went to New York, visited my family, and got a Cuban visa in my French passport.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Then I took off from New York and flew to Mexico. And I entered Mexico with my American passport. And then the next day, I left Mexico on my French passport with the Cuban visa. But there was one thing that I was really nervous about as I did that, which was that I hoped that the people controlling the passports wouldn't realize that my French passport didn't show me entering Mexico. So mm-hmm. I entered on my American passport. I don't know why I did that. But anyway, that was a long 3 hours waiting there to get on the plane. In those days, the whole routine for anybody who was flying to Cuba took hours to actually get from the front door of the airport to a plane going to Cuba. And I had sent ahead a message to someone whose name I had been given to say that I was coming and to please meet me, but nobody met me. But fortunately, I made friends with two Canadian journalists who had already been to Cuba and whom I was seated next to on the plane. So they kind of took me under their wing. And from there, I just winged it, went to the Foreign Affairs Press Office, which was the entity that was dealing with foreign journalists at the time, and presented my request, which was to do a portrait of Fidel Castro for a very big French weekly called Paris Match. They didn't want anything political. They just wanted a portrait of the person.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for 3 weeks I did all kinds of things, going around looking at people in Havana and trying to get in touch with Castro and bothering the press office, and they just didn't take me very seriously. A woman, no affiliation, and things were not going very well between the West and Cuba at that time, so they weren't eager to facilitate the work of an unknown quantity coming from the West, I guess. And finally, as I was due to leave in a couple of days, I kind of lost my temper with this guy at the press office, and I gave him a dressing down, and the next day I was contacted by someone who said that I would be able to see the head of propaganda for the Cuban Communist Party on the day I was supposed to leave. And, well, that was quite impressive. I mean, you don't exactly anticipate finding yourself face-to-face with a propagandist for communism. And I went there and I discovered somebody who was very much like a sort of Latin teacher that I had had in the past. And we got along very well. We had very spirited discussions about how much you can string out requests by journalists before they get really mad. And finally, he said that he would make sure that my request got to Fidel. And when I said, yeah, but I'm supposed to be on a plane 2 hours from now, he said, well, if you want to catch the plane, I'll tell them to wait. But if you want to stay, you'll be our guest. Because I had run out of money, of course, after
right.
3 weeks. And then I was presented with this drama of deciding whether to accept the hospitality of the people that I was going to write for. I had about 30 seconds, of course, to make that decision. As you can imagine, I said, okay. And 2 days later was when I came face to face with Fidel Castro, just as this other person, Cesar Escalante, had promised. And Fidel kept me up until, I don't know, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, because this started at midnight, and I had no Spanish to speak of, only Italian and French. And he was very patient. His doctor and aide, Dr. Vallejo, Comandante Vallejo, was with him and spoke perfect English because he'd been trained in the United States. And after a couple of hours, he got up and left, and I was left to fend for myself. And I don't take notes. My way of interviewing people at that time was just to retain everything in my head. Of course, there were no mechanical ways to record a conversation at that time. And so basically, Fidel, he decided to trust me on the basis of my own story, on the fact that I wasn't part of a news organization. I had no affiliations. I was just all by myself. So he judged me as a person. And I think he felt that my curiosity was genuine and that I wanted to do something that that we could all be pleased with. So that's how I met with him 5 times in the 3 weeks that followed, turned in my story to Paris Match. Then I received an invitation to come back because one of my complaints to Fidel had been that we were not allowed to go out of Havana. At that time, Western journalists were not allowed to travel. So when the article came out, they invited me to come back. I contacted an Italian publisher because I decided that if I were going back, I would want to elucidate the big question that was on everybody's minds at that time in the world of journalism, in any case, which was whether Fidel Castro had been lying to Herbert Matthews of the New York Times when he visited him in the Sierra before they took over and said that they weren't communists. That was the big question still in 1963. Mm-hmm. And so I decided that since I had the goodwill of the Cuban government, I would try to speak to all the government members, all the ministers, and get their own version of why they joined the revolution, and also, more importantly, what they understood the purpose of the revolution to be, the project. And so during the year that followed, the 9 months that followed, I met with every member of the government. I met with Fidel another few times. I met with Raul, Celia Sanchez, everybody. And Che, of course.
Wow.
Yeah. And at the end, I think that I had formulated a pretty accurate position of what had driven the Cuban rebels to decide that they had to go for some form of socialism because, as they told me, they couldn't do what they wanted to do under a liberal parliamentary system. There was there was all that land that had to be redistributed. There were all those people who couldn't read. I mean, it was only after they had been in power for, I think, a year or two, that they realized that they had to do it differently from the way they had thought they could do it when they were in the Sierra.
Right. When you said that you were conflicted about the reports you were hearing from the media about Cuba and what people who had actually been there were saying, did you find any difference between, say, how maybe Italian press or French press or Canadian press reported about the revolution as to how press in the United States reported about it?
I guess I wasn't really focused on comparing the different Western presses. Mm-hmm. But I can say that at that time, the European press was beginning to echo the American press, not as badly as they do now, but the main center journal news outlets, the center right, the center left, they pretty much mimicked the American line. But you had people from the European Communist or Socialist parties who, of course, saw through all that and, you know, formulated things differently.
At the time, was there like, what was travel between other states like Canada and Europe, was it free to, I'm not free monetarily, but was it unrestricted to go to Cuba? Because I know when I've been to Cuba, and I didn't go to Cuba before the fall of the Soviet Union, obviously, but it's a popular vacation destination for many people around the world, and they don't even think twice or have to think twice about going to Cuba.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. When I came back the one and only time in 2011, when the Italian version of my book was presented at the Havana Book Fair, the place was full of people from all over the world.
Right.
And when I was there in the early 60s, there were foreign journalists there as well. But there wasn't there weren't a lot of foreigners going there for vacation, because obviously it wasn't really set up for tourism at that time. The government, I think, had all it could handle with just doing everyday things. They hadn't set up a tourism industry, even though, of course, one existed before, but it was in the hands of the mafia. All the casinos and brothels and everything that went with that, they had to shut all that down and start from scratch eventually. But there were French journalists and British journalists and Belgians and Italians and a lot of people coming to Cuba because they were interested in the revolution, or they had something to propose to Fidel, like, I don't know, somebody from Italy who was going to set up a cheese factory in Cuba. So there was even an Indian who, after waiting for about a month, decided he couldn't spare any more time and he left. So it was very cosmopolitan already then in terms of, you know, who was there, but it wasn't mass travel to Cuba, of course.
It's very compelling. The story is very compelling. When you met Che Guevara and spent time with him, what were your impressions of him? He's got this huge, larger-than-life romantic hint to him, whether, you know, it's somebody who admires him or somebody who thinks that he was a cold-blooded mass murderer. What was your impression of him?
Oh, my goodness, yeah, that... He was not keen on meeting with me, but with pressure from Celia Sanchez, he accepted reluctantly, and we had an appointment in his office at 11 o'clock in the morning, and I was a few minutes late, and he was a little bit annoyed at that. Mm-hmm. And then we sat 2 feet apart in his office and talked for about an hour, and it was clear that he didn't have much patience with women with brains, let me say.
Right.
While at the same time, he was known to be very puritanical. And when I asked him a question about that, because he had been traveled to China once or twice before we met, and the Chinese at that time were known to have a very puritanical public image in terms of social relations. And I asked him about that, and he said, well, you know, I agree with them because, you know, if you're trying to make a revolution, you can't spend time buying flowers and sending chocolates and flitting around from one woman to the other.
Right.
And of course I would take pictures of all the people that I was interviewing as I talked to them. And I took an absolutely stunning picture of Che Guevara that doesn't in any way look like the one everybody is used to seeing, shows his complete, what can I say, how skeptical he is of other people, in a way almost cynical. And a couple of months after I sent him a print of that picture, my pictures, by the way, were developed by Alberto Corda, who was Fidel's photographer and everybody knows now in the West. and I sent Che this wonderful picture. And then a few months later, I met him on the presidential reviewing stand. There was some event, I don't remember what, maybe May 1st or something like that. And I asked him if he had gotten my picture and did he like it? And he said, no, he didn't like it. And I said, I bet you can't take a better one of me. So he grabbed my camera and he took a picture of me, which is the picture that you see on the front cover, although it's melded with other images. That's the picture that Che Guevara took of me. Wow. I was 30 years old at the time. It made me look like a kindly grandmother. I was kindly, but I wasn't a grandmother.
When I have been to Cuba, and I've always been welcomed warmly there. I've never, unfortunately, got to meet Fidel or spend any time with him. But to me, I see a contradiction between like the traditional Latin machismo with the egalitarian aims and goals of communism, because many of the top officials, top party leaders and government officials are female. So I think I see the struggle between machismo and equality in Cuba. And not until recently have they been more accepting of LGBT.
Right. And that's thanks to Raul's daughter.
She's a wonderful person.
Yeah. Of course, I met her when she was 3 years old. Oh. That's really funny.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I have been following what she did. And, I don't know if I'm understanding your question quite correctly.
Well, I don't know if it's a question or an observation. You were talking about Che, how it seemed like he didn't really have patience for women with brains. And what I've learned about him is he was a dedicated revolutionary that had a laser beam focus. But mm-hmm. when I'm in Cuba, when I'm around the, the leaders there in Cuba, I do see a struggle between in the males between the machismo and struggling for gender equality.
You see a struggle. Well, of course, when I came back in 2011, I wasn't there long enough to get an impression about that. But I did notice that there were a lot of women in what seemed like very important positions, including at the book fair, which was a huge event. I don't know if you know about the Havana
book. Oh, yes, I do. Yeah.
It's a huge event. And the women who held the key positions in making that thing run, they were women. They were young women. And they were made up, and they had clothes that were, I don't know who designed them, but some designer must have been behind the uniforms they wore. And they were very much in control of whatever it is they were doing, and they gave a sense of authority, very, very strong sense of authority, which, of course, the women that I met in 1963 did not have.
Right.
But I'll tell you about Celia Sanchez, who was Fidel's right-hand person, who the most trusted of anybody in his circle. She had been with the revolution since the Sierra, and nothing happened without her knowing about it or her making sure it happened. That's how I got to meet all those other ministers, because she would call them up and she would say, you have to meet her. And then there was Raul's wife, who was head of the Women's Federation at the time I was there. And she was enforcing strict monogamy. In fact, the woman who cleaned my hotel room came to me one day and said that one of her friends had been kicked out of her job at the Havana Libre because the Women's Federation in the hotel, the hotel cell or whatever you want to call it, knew she was having an affair with somebody and that that was not acceptable, so she lost her job. And when I went to interview Vilma, Raul's wife, Vilma Espín, I put the question to her, and she was very uncomfortable with it, I have to say.
Well, so, and I wonder how many men lost their jobs because for having affairs, because I don't think that that's very uncommon in Cuba for well, or anywhere, really.
But, yeah, but the point was that the women would lose their job, but not the men.
I see. Well, things have changed in Cuba and around the world, too, but not as fast as we would like them to.
Right.
Well, talk about Fidel. I mean, to me, he is, you know, this larger-than-life figure in world history. The U.S., it's been proven that they tried to assassinate him hundreds of times. Mm-hmm. He's almost 90. And right. He writes, I don't think he makes very many public appearances, but I think he writes brilliant analysis, and mm-hmm. especially of what's going on between Cuba and the United States right now.
Right, absolutely. And I think if he had stayed in power and not had to step down because of health reasons, this might not have happened.
Right.
I think that, you know, he gave Raul full authority, and, you know, I don't think he's ever put it into question. But had he still been the head of the government, I don't think he would have made peace under these conditions. I think if it had happened, it would have had to have been much more to Cuba's advantage. And I sense in the things that he's writing and the few things that I hear through the grapevine, he can't be happy. And in fact, a couple of months ago, he did appear at the Communist Party plenum or some right. big thing, and he said, I'm not going to be around for very long. And when it happened last year, I felt that this would be the end of him, that he would be so unhappy about this that his health would probably feel the consequences.
Well, I just want to tell a quick story. The first time I went to Cuba was in the beginning of 2007, and I've been there 6 times by now, I think. I started working really hard with the International Committee to Free the Cuban Five. Ah. And once I was in Holguín at the Cuban Five colloquium, and I had a necklace that my son Casey had given me, you know, when he was in the army. Mm-hmm. And I gave it to the mothers, and I said, this is my pledge to you that I'm going to work really hard to free your sons. And mm-hmm. when your sons come back to Cuba, I want to come back here, come back and get my necklace. And so, of course, the Cuban Five have been back now for almost 2 years, and I haven't been to Cuba to collect my necklace yet. Nobody there would, like, answer. Like, I would send emails and stuff, and I'd be, hi, I want to come and get my necklace, you know, like we promised. And I finally got something for Mother's Day this year to mm-hmm. be there. And they were going to have a celebration. The Cuban Five were going to be there, all the families. And then they were going to present my necklace. Well, like a day before I was leaving, the trip got canceled because the Cuban Five were going to be out of the country. But this had been planned for a couple months.
Oh, this sounds typically Cuban.
Well, typically Cuban, but also it seems to me that this rapprochement between Cuba and the United States might also be a factor.
Why would that be?
Well, because I was welcomed there as an anti-imperialist, anti-war person.
Right. That could be. You're right.
And now, I'm not a friend of the United States, the government. I am actively fighting against the government here. And so I can't help but think that that might be a factor. But it is typically Cuban and human for something like that to happen, but I don't think it would have happened before the U.S. Like you said, the U.S. made peace with Cuba.
Did they offer another date or say we'll not yet?
Not yet. So I'm just my friend Gloria LaRiva is going in August. I'm going to tell her just to pick it up and bring it back to me because
don't want to get in the way of all this high diplomacy.
Yeah. So
I'm really worried about what's going to happen. I have to tell you.
Go ahead and tell us why.
Well, I just think that the U.S. doesn't give anything for a small price, and partly because of unemployment there, whatever. I think that they will take advantage of the situation, and all these people from Florida with big ideas about making big money in Cuba. Mm-hmm. The place is going to be turned upside down. I really feel that. And what I worry the most about is the change that it will bring to what turned out to be a sort of new man, as Che hoped it would, where people weren't working for the almighty peso, that they viewed other things in life more important than stuff, and, you know, that whole trip. I'm afraid they will fall into the trap.
It was refreshing to go somewhere where there wasn't a Starbucks or a McDonald's on every corner also.
Right.
And I'm feeling like if they're going to welcome U.S. tourism, they're going to have to make big changes, unfortunately.
Oh, do you think in the sense of having Starbucks that they have to have that to have tourists?
Well, there's going to be I've been in a market in Amman, Jordan, in a market that was like centuries, if not millennia old, that had a Starbucks in it. So, you know, let's just talk about, I was very happy to have you on this week because the show's going to first appear, you know, on the 3rd of July. So this is the 4th of July weekend. And I often get, people often tell me that, oh, the Cuban Revolution, it was so bloody and violent and blah, blah, blah. And I'm all like, well, what about our revolution? Are revolutions only good if they happen in the 1700s and if they were a bourgeois revolution and not a true people's revolution? Can you speak to that?
Wow. I think even more so, you know, our Declaration of Independence says that people are bound to change the government for a better one if they're, you know, if there's a really bad government. And that phrase has been just sort of wiped off the historical map, so to speak. Nobody ever talks about that.
Mm-hmm.
It's been completely, conveniently forgotten. And it's kind of similar to the way the Second Amendment now has been reinterpreted to mean that every civilian can carry a gun, whereas at the time the Second Amendment was written, it was about having a militia. And, you know, people just are convinced today that, no, it meant that every Tom, Dick, and Harry could walk around with a gun. So, I mean, it's not surprising, is it? So many things. Today, we designate people either as rebels or as terrorists, depending on what their politics are.
Exactly. That's basically the bottom line. So yeah. Dina Stryker, author of Cuba, A Diary of the Revolution. I will put the links to the book and everything on the newsletter when I send it out. But in case people listen to the show and they haven't read the newsletter, how can they get more information?
How to?
Get more information about your book, Cuba, A Diary of the Revolution.
Well, they can go to Amazon.com and hopefully do a search inside the book, or they can go to Tie In Lane, the publisher, or they can send me an email at deanstrike@gmail.com. I don't know if it's a good idea to put the email address out there, but
hopefully you won't get inundated, but hopefully you will. I don't know. I just think that my listeners will be very interested in this topic and very interested in your book. And I just really keep on trucking there. You sound like a teenager. And so thank you for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Have a good weekend.
You too.
That's the soapbox for this week. As always, I hope you were informed and inspired to check out the Cuban Revolution and Dina's book. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar. I'd like to thank Dina Stryker for taking time to be on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. And I'd like to thank you for listening to and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to The Soapbox. Peace out for now.